May 28, 1980, Long Beach, California. A, you don't have to hold it.
Well, as I said, we were driving along beautiful San Antonio Drive, and my friend commented, what beautiful wide streets, all beautiful trees. So I said, well, in the 1920s, this was known as the Daikon Ranch. It's all turning sugar beets. And my friend, one of the farmers, Mr. Higashi, lived on one of the ranches. And the house was set, maybe 100 or 150 feet into the ranch. And that's where he had his little house. And I said, it was my job, why would the job be secretary here, to take all the telephone calls and help any emergencies that I could. And I often received telephone calls 2 o'clock in the night. My wife is having a baby. They would yell over the telephone, come quick, bring a doctor, and a couple of nurses. So it used to happen on a rainy, stormy night, and had a very fine doctor. Rather than the late gentleman, Dr. Montgomery. He had faculties on Abuso, and he was the closest, because I was Don Marino, and I would give Dr. Montgomery a call and tell him what the situation was. He said, hold on, he said, don't get nervous, he said, I'll bring nurses and pick you up. And in those days, he was having closed cars, and on a rainy, windy night, it was awful, you know, the riding's open cars. But we made the trip. When we came up here, the man told me that I'll be out in the front waving a lantern on San Antonio, so you'll be able to find me. Sure enough, he'd be out there with his raincoat on, swinging the lantern. He'd say, well, there it is, there it is. I'd go and drive up that muddy dirt road, and his wife would already be in labor. And all he had was butane stoves. Heated water and sterilized instruments and a kerosene lamp. So you can imagine what the poor doctor had to go. But luckily, all the cases were very easy labor, as the babies and mothers were very well and strong. Everything turned out satisfactory. So that's how it was. As I would come back, next time the child would be sick on Signal Hill, and I'd have to go up there. Nobody had any thing like hot water bottles. We had the heated jug and filled full of hot water rather than several pieces of towels. We sat for a hot water bottle. I'd just fall at every time I see those big palm trees up on Signal Hill. And I'd just go there. I think of that family with that children living in that little shack. They had so much sickness. So that's how we took care of our sick people. And we were the welfare, the legal department, everything. We had one very fine doctor who donated his services on Sundays. And most farmers didn't have much money. And it was very hard to ask them to pay any set sum. So we just asked them if they would like to drop a quarter in this jar. And I turned the dining room table into an examining table. I put like things on there. Every Sunday from 9 to 12, it was open for medical purposes. So we opened up a public clinic that way. And it was a good thing because we found 2 children who had hernias. And if they were left any longer, it would have been very dangerous and fatal to their life. So different things like that happened. And children who appeared to be healthy when they were brought into the clinic and went through several tests and proved that they had something wrong. So we referred them to this doctor. And that was all the child's 25 cents to pay for tongue depressants and cotton balls. I took care of it. It was called the Japanese Association. We took care of all of our needy people that way. So we just asked for any assistance, any organization to help us.
Yeah. I think before you talked about raising money for the church also.
Oh, that was in 1924, yes. When we first started to realize there were so many children who needed some kind of religious training. Their parents are all from Japan who was naturally Buddhist. There are about five or six different divisions of Buddhists, like the Protestant churches here, like Methodist different sections. And that was being American, they were born in this country, and they were American citizens, so we thought they all should have an American religious education and stress Christianity. My husband spearheaded this effort and called a meeting and asked how many were in favor and what house we should begin to raise the money. And so the initial down payment had to be at least $10,000 to buy the property. And in those days, it seemed a big fortune. And so I remember I used to go on Sunday just for the ride. I was so tired of being set up in the office all week. I would go for the ride with my husband. The farmers would be picking on Sunday for Monday's market. And the women would be out there. And you know that dense things like red radishes and spinach and turnips were a dollar and a quarter a crate. You know, that's how they sold. So that's why we were able to sell them in the retail market for 2 for 5 cents for dime. And I knew how hard it was for the women getting down on their knees. Somehow the baby stuck on the bed, picking. And when each family was asked to donate $100, it just hurt me to think that my husband had to ask that, you know, to raise this amount of money. So our membership included people in, I guess still there, a town called Stanton and Fountain Valley and Westminster. And then Norwalk and Downey and Dominguez. And there used to be a place called Keystone. I think it's changed now, but it was near Gardena. And all of these areas of San Pedro, we had to go everywhere and raise the $100 that was so high. And so few had them. So we didn't press them, but all those who were willing. We said the church is going to be yours and your children, and we would conduct funeral services there, any kind of service they required a minister or priest, they were welcome to use the hall. And in that way, we finally raised that mission. So, some time ago, that's been 15 or 20 years ago, our minister was getting so discouraged because our congregation was falling. Well, that reason was that the children were growing up and going to college. As they were growing out of state, and their studies were so heavy they couldn't attend every Sunday. And that's why our congregation is going down. And our minister suggested, why don't we merge with another church or sell it? And we kept taking votes. And it got to the point where I couldn't keep quiet anymore. So I got up and I said, Reverend Julia, I said, most of the people who donate the money to build this church have passed on. But I would like to speak for them. I told about the history, about how we raised $100 from each family, how they worked hard in the fields. And I said, it's such a backbreaking job for these women, especially. I said, I can't see the church being sold like any other piece of property. I said, it has such a deep sentimental value to me. And I said, I think of all these people that I remember. I can't possibly let you sell this church, no matter how the votes turn. I said, let's do something else and keep it. And so I kept arguing and arguing. And we finally decided to keep it. That's how it's so happy. But in those days, as children grew older, they brought their friends, and it was a very wonderful church for the war. We had choirs, we had our dress, when we were in college, it was so sorry. And we had some very wonderful times. And so many weddings, and of course, an opportunity to have it. And I think, as a rule, as by nature, Japanese was rather shy. They couldn't think of going to a Caucasian church to have their funeral services. They would feel more comfortable in their little old church. And I think for purposes of that kind, I think that we should keep our church. And it certainly has proven worthy so far.
Where's it located?
It's right across Locust, 1336 Locust Avenue. It's centrally located. And we have the whole corner. So but during the war, we didn't know what to do with it. It's left it as is. And the Council of Churches, I believe, took it over. And they sent it into the Boys Club. And then I believe they sold that corner. So when we came back, the church was still occupied. And the Boys Club used it for 3 years, 4 years. And they were pretty rough, just full of holes and everything. So we had a big repair job. But we asked for everybody to come and volunteer. Some of the women, they made lunches, and we brought lunches, and spent days painting and mending. And we didn't have to hire any professional help. So we got the church back in shape. But it's still standing. Right now we're having an interim minister, but we hope to get a permanent minister pretty soon. Finance has been kind of difficult to get together. But we had a very fine friend, Mrs. Joan Brown, donated her a garage apartment on Pine Avenue right in back of our church to us and left us some money. And the advisor of our women's association, Mrs. Janet Smith, she passed away in 61. But she was formerly a missionary teacher in Sapporo, Japan. That's in Hokkaido, the southernmost island of Japan. She was a missionary teacher there for many years and spoke Japanese. And the Issei people, the first generation people, they, well, in fact, we all thought the world of her because she was such a sweet person. She understood our needs, she understood our language, and she was so helpful in many ways. And when she passed away, she left $2,500 also. Some of these help donations we were able to survive. So it's been a very interesting history.
One of the other things you talked about is when you went with your husband to try to collect the money to start the church in the beginning, you talked about the conditions that you saw on the Bushy Ranch among the people that raised salaries.
Yes.
I wonder if you could tell about that on the page.
Oh, yes. Well, one of the sad things that we saw when we went to collect the rent was that I usually would get out, and but the children, I had about 3 children there, left to walk around and exercise while we were waiting for my husband. We had to walk about, oh, say, a quarter of a mile way out to the nip of the ranch where they were working. It was very hard to get the men to come in because they're so busy, and at night they're very tired. And while we were waiting, I heard a baby cry. And I thought, my, that cry sounds so close. So I couldn't help but go up to the little house, and I peeked in the window. And there was this baby tied with sheets and pieces of, you know, drove to the bedstead. And it was a warm day, and the flies were on its face, and I couldn't get in to help it. I was so nervous and all of that. I couldn't understand how a mother could do such a thing, leave her baby tied like that. So when my husband came back, I told him what I saw. And I said, "You should speak to that mother. She shouldn't do such a thing." He said, "Look," he said, "these mothers have to go out there and work. And they would love to stay home to care their babies. But it's impossible." He probably left him sleeping with a bottle. That's why his bottle is empty, full of flies. And she had to leave the window partly open for fresh air. And the baby woke up in the meantime and got hungry and was crying. I don't know how long, but she knows he'll have to come back when she thinks it's time. So don't worry. But I thought how sad to have to leave the baby like that. And I remember how all these conditions were under which they worked. So it made me appreciate all the more the amount of money that they donated to the church. And the women always wore men's shoes, high top shoes. They wore jeans. So when I see young people strutting around in their blue jeans, I said, "Oh, I've seen that before, but it wasn't under fashionable conditions. It was because of necessity." They wore men's clothes, and they worked out with those bonnets. Do you know what a bonnet is? Has this wide brim. And to protect their hands, they wore handmade gloves. They made themselves. So they worked side by side with the men. But when I read of the olden times, I think back in the United States, too, in New England and Middle West, the women were hard workers, too. They also worked on the farms with their husbands. So it wasn't only Japanese. But it was very interesting to know. And my mother came from the city. So when she first came to Pasadena and she saw the neighbors using hose and grabbing the hose and watering their yards, she thought, "Why, the American women are brave. They go out there and do all those things." She said, "Why, we were ostracized in Japan if we did that." So finally, in no time at all, she started doing the same thing.
What did the house look like that the people lived on
before you had the family? Well, those out on Dixie Ranch, they were old houses. But I don't know, from our present standards, they were pretty rickety, you know. I guess they were rainproofed, and but they had no heating, no plumbing. They all had outside their outhouses. And for bears, I remember one year, one of the men with his wife went to Japan because I think her mother or his mother was very sick and she was dying. And they wanted to see the children. They had never seen the children. So they decided to go back. And they wanted to give a farewell, the neighbors wanted to give a farewell party. And there were four families living out there. So they asked me, would I come out and make some kind of American dessert for them? So they came after me in the morning. I wasn't prepared for them to come so early. I had no oven myself, but I thought if I went out there, I could make something, you know, a custard or something that I could cook on the stove. So they said, "Don't bring anything. We have milk, we have sugar, we have flour." So I just guessed. So they took them out there, and they were all making things inside, and by 5 o'clock it was beginning to get kind of dark, so they were lighting the kerosene lamps, and because I was the secretary's wife, they thought that I should take a bath with my children first, and they said, "The bath is ready." So I thought, "Where is the bathroom? I have a bath with me." And you know, it was a square box under a canopy under a tree. And they had made a fire under this big wooden box. It was, I think the bottom was all lined on the underside. It was a sheet of galvanized tin or something, and it was sitting on blocks, sort of a concrete platform. And they had burned the fire directly under it. And he said, you sit out here and soak up and then soak, and then you get into this water and warm up. I had never taken a bath outside, and I just wouldn't. So I dipped some warm water out of the big, you know, tub, and I washed the children's faces before I gave them a sponge bath, and I did the same, washed my face. But then later, I was so curious, I had to leave the kitchen, go out there to pee. I saw about 5 women in that tub together talking and singing. And then later, I saw 5 men out there. And I thought to myself, that's what I think. And then they had this other shed where they dressed, you know. But I suppose when you had no bathroom inside, that's what you had to do. But we had a wonderful time. They had wash pans, chicken marinated in soy sauce and sugar and ginger. They would bring that in and bring that over to the open fire and barbecue it. And it just felt just wonderful. It tasted just as good. But that's how life was. And the Dixie houses were well built. The Dixie family were very, very nice to all the renters. They treated them like good close friends. I think the relationship was fine. And then we had one man, Mr. Abe, way out to the beach. He was the man who raised nothing but red radishes, which take only 3 weeks for them to mature and be ready for market, and parsley. And he was a very religious man. He was one of the leaders of our church here. All his parents and children, between 5 and 6 children. And he used to supply all the meat markets with parsley and grocery stores with red radishes. They were the easiest things to grow. And he could have the children pick, and he could have his wife go out there and supervise while he attended the church duties. But I remember one Christmas, our butcher was telling me, said that one of his friend butchers at a market, I forgot the name of that big market, it's right across from City Hall, First Street and Linden, I believe. Well, anyway, he said, Mr. Otter came in Christmas Eve to sell his things. And he said, Merry Christmas. And he said, he gave all the men cigars. And he went up to the cashier and looked at her and paused a minute. And he was thinking, what could I give her? I can't give her cigars. So I pulled out 10 dollars and gave it to her. And all the other guys, the butchers, they said, hey, I trade my cigars for And I have never gone to Mr. Abbey's house, but I think this is another old house. And it was usually a one room. And as the family grew, they had to make additions, but they were either crates or galvanized metal or makeshift things that they could collect. Because in those days, we weren't allowed to buy or lease property. And it was just a makeshift thing we knew just from year to year until our rent was paid, whether we were going to stay there any longer or not. So they couldn't afford to put anything up that was costly. But most of the houses were makeshift, but they were livable, and the women and the men worked hard to make it so for the children. So we never had too much sickness. Or too many children going to see the doctor in those days. Most of the little ills were taken care of at home, I guess.
Yes,
thank you too. I think the owners put the houses up for them. I could tell they weren't painted, that this wasn't new lumber. I think some were just sort of fabricated houses, put up, you know, the sides put up together and built that way.
And they didn't have running water, or did they have plumbing?
No, they had no plumbing. They had the pots, and they had the little outhouses and everything, so, but they all had their zapper bags, these big wooden boxes, like I mentioned, the little roof over for protection on rainy days. And I think they seemed to enjoy that.
One thing we didn't talk about last time is what happened during World War II. I wonder if you could tell, like, where you were living and what happened to you.
In 1930, we had just got our own home. Up until then, our school board furnished a house for us. So we lived there, but in 1930, I told my husband, I would like to raise children in their own home and have them in a community where they could have schools and churches close by within walking distance. And it would be nice to have it near bus lines. And of course, at that time, we had a street guy was down on the boulevard. So we found this place on Locust Avenue, just between Locust and 20th. We had the church close by, we had the Admiral School on 15th and Pacific, and had Patty High within walking distance, and Hamilton Junior High was down on Pacific Coast Highway, so it was very convenient. And we built our first house there, and we had lived there only about 12 years, finished in 1930, and then in 1932 we had to evacuate. So I had to rent to someone real quick because we only had 2 weeks' time to make our decision. For a long time, since December, I had heard rumors that we might have to evacuate, but I couldn't understand why or how so many people could be relocated to a different area. But then, as time went on, it became more and more evident. The first contingent went to Manzanar Camp. That was the first one. I think Manzanar is in Northern California, up in Fresno. And the first rumors we had were that it was in a very desert area, and there were rattlesnakes. So if you have to go there, be sure and buy boots and be prepared for rattlesnakes. So I don't know why, but we believe everything we hear, I guess. And sort of, yeah, I went out, and with what little money I had, I bought boots. And then my family, my husband and my 3 children, all their glasses. So I thought the first thing, I'd have to have their eyes examined and extra pair of glasses made for them. And my husband was ailing with heart trouble. Ever since the earthquake, you know, our star was acknowledged. We had a star on the corner of 1st and Alameda then, and a big spell on his shoulders and collapsed along, and then developed heart ailment. And so I thought, well, I'll take him to the doctor and ask him what kind of medication he could give me, and what kind of a doctor I should contact and tell him what I should tell him in case his heart got worse in camp. So all this information I had to get. And then they said you can only carry one suitcase or one box, but you can carry, everybody has to carry their own baggage, and no more. So I went down and I tried to suitcase to some stable around $20, $19, $20. Can't get much in a suitcase. So then I figured I'll just make something. I spent the pennies and I bought some heavy canvas material and I made duffel bags. I put strings on them and it's kind of funny when you start to think of it now. I stuffed extra shoes, the old shoes, and stuffed changes of clothes. And I knew there was no sense in taking dress-up clothes, so I put all those in the dress store and had my son nail up half of our double garage. And I put in a platform about 8 inches off the cement floor. And then I put the dresser and some of the bedroom things that I didn't sell. The second-hand dealers came around and wanted to sell them everything for about $25. And I knew that if he ever came back, I would need some of them. So I kept most of them. And half of them I left at the house because the people I rented to were an old couple. And they said, we have no dining table, have no sofa, and I'll take care of them if you need them. So I left the rugs, my trust them to take care of them. But like the bedroom furniture and the mattresses, I thought I should store those. I put those in the garage. I put the good clothes away. And I just took the strong, everyday clothes. And I stuffed those all in the duffel bag. And you could practice every night. Back and forth, now can you carry this? Let's stuff one more thing, and now can you carry it? That's how we did it, to go to camp. We took a duffel bag. And that time they gave us out the papers. Oh, before that, they said to be ready at 6 o'clock. And so at 6 o'clock, we were all dressed, we were out in front waiting, and the Quaker people were very nice. The church people came and picked us up, and they took us down to the train station. Red car depot, I guess. It's down by Loma Vista somewhere. And boarded the red car and went to Santa Anita. And our first apartment was there. They gave out papers of apartment 78 and 77 or something like that. So apartments, maybe they belong to the jockeys. But how many jockeys accommodate all these people? When we got there, they were the stables. And they had just removed the horses. And they had put blacktop. And then we went down to the barn and they gave us a canvas bag and we stuffed it with hay. So we stuffed it with hay and couldn't imagine what that was for. But every day we carried these sacks back and they said, this is your apartment. And then there in the inner half was dark and then had this half door that you could swing open and then had the other half. So they gave us two of those stalls, and then there was seven of us, five of the children and my husband and I. So I was just comfortable. I thought that we could have a lot of fresh air and still felt like horses. And there was rusty nails with long horsehairs hanging on it, and some of the walls were just awfully dirty. So I thought, to where the mess hall was and asked my boy to bring back some empty cans. And I tore things and I washed down the wall the best I could. Then I made the bed and put my husband to bed first. And then we had folding cots, canvas folding cots. They gave us each one of those. But our body weight went right through the asphalt and the legs got buried in there. And before we knew it, I think the oats started to grow up around it. Dead left. We had to put in those. And then I heard that they were building some temporary housing for us. So then I ordered some 19 going on 20. And he said that he volunteered for carpenter work. So you have a job? He said, yes, I have to volunteer. So I volunteered. And he said, volunteer will be the first one to get a home. So that's why I volunteered. Now he can't think that it's probably going to get worse and worse. I said, if I can hardly stand it. Now, that's when it rang, that March 10th, or April 3rd, when it rang. And then we had rain. And then when it rained, it just rained down the ditches, and we could just smell the fog all the more. So I developed this movie into town. So it was like a little one-room house. But it was better than what we were, you know. And so we moved in there, and it was right near a little cut-out ditch, and then on the other side was a post office. So, and then we had olive trees, which made it pleasant. So we had a nice little location out there. And we stayed there for 6 months. Then on the 10th of October, we used to notice that we were going to move to a new location, but they never told us where. And they said it was kind of cold in the winter time. So we would have to prepare for cold weather. Well, so we went to camp. They tried to give us each person $2 a month. That was as far as we were. Medicaid or whatever we needed. So we would take $3 a month. And then some people received catalogs from Montgomery Ward and Sears Roebuck. Things were much cheaper those days. So they used to send their money to for mail orders and watch what came into the post office that would have packages. It was interesting to watch. And most everybody asked for a sweater, or the men asked for a jacket. And so that's how we could have money. Then when we got the money, we had to go to the, whatever bus, and then we went, boarded a train about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And that train took us to Indio. We had a supper on the train to go park in India. And then that night we started traveling to Arizona. And we said, don't raise the blinds. We had to keep the blinds down, complete darkness. And the supper, and they just took the blinds. And we saw a lot of Indian people squatting on the ground. They saw the tariff train, I guess, and they had these different things to sell. They said, no, but it gets off the train. They had the people going through. People were sit down in their lights. There was no flashlights. But that aspect was Arizona, then went into Texas. And Texas, I didn't realize it, but the big state people there traveled 3 days and 3 nights of it. Every day they'd wake up to the fire place. Someone would say, I said, Texas. Next day, what's this place? Texas. And it was very high in Texas. So they stare out my windows. Very warm. So many people. And my youngest boy, who lives here now that I'm living with, he was 4 years old then. And the last day, in Santa Anita, they had taken all the blankets away except one for each bed. And, you know, children sort of throw the blankets off and that's a cup cold. And he was feverish all those 3 days that I had to have someone start when I was here and rested my arm on the window ledge and had him on my lap. This arm is just about paralyzed. Oh, but they didn't know where we were going. And somewhere along in Texarkana, I think they said, they let us off to go out. And into the field and to get the bathroom. And then they kind of just had this yell because they couldn't run away, so they would go anyway. I heard later that was Texarkana. I went from Denver into Arkansas. And I had no idea for going into Arkansas. But it must have been a dense forest. It looked like a lot of trees had been cut down to the ground and leveled off. And the section between the trees was very sandy, I noticed. And a truck took all of our baggage and dumped it off at our block. I think there were four some buildings in two blocks. And by that time, my boy was better, but I was sick. And then, but I was so grimy and dirty, I thought I had to take a shower. I then said, there's no house water, but I took a cold shower and with that made the condition worse. I was down a terrible fever. I was sick in bed for 3 days. But when I did get better and began to eat and get my strength back, by then, I noticed that we were in the corner apartment. There were long barracks, and I think it was divided up into eight sections for eight families. So it was the end one, which is the big one. And I woke up and I noticed that everything was kind of and nice. It was still going and there was lots of fire. I thought, my goodness, I wonder what that is. Something's on fire and sparks are flying over. Someone laughed at me and he said, do you know this is Arkansas and those are fireflies? I said, I had never heard of or saw fireflies before. And the children had a look and they were watching the fireflies and stuff. I said, how do you catch them? That was our experience in Arkansas. Then November began to get colder, and then they put in some of these old-fashioned wood stove for us, which is such a blessing because it snowed and was very cold. And the trees that they had cut down, they were all piled up outside the camp. And the volunteers were loggers to go out there and saw. And I never went out there, but I think they used a two-man saw. One pushes, another pulls. And they chopped, and they brought those back, and they piled them all up in the middle of the camp. And they would have a meeting in the mess hall, and each family was to allotted so many logs. So everybody went and got their share and piled it up in front of their front door. And that's when we burned. And it helped so much to keep us warm in the winter time. And that was the first winter. We had seen snow. We had experienced beautiful foliage in the forest. I'm allergic to poison oak and ivy and things like that. So I didn't venture into the forest. But some people were brave. They went about 25 feet into the forest to admire the changing leaves and see the wild persimmons, and they had a lot of wild flowers that we'd never seen out in California, and went out to see those things. But I thought it was so interesting at first. But life is hard, you know, with a cold winter. And at first we had no school, and the children thought it was a long holiday. They'd get together at first we had control of our children because we went to the mess hall as a family. And we sat at one table together. But as time went on, they made friends and they'd say, why don't you ask your mom if you can come to our mess hall? We have better food. It's the same thing, but I guess they thought they had something different. And she said, can I go? Can I go? Well, I said, they have so many people that they have to feed, and if you go, that makes somebody have less food. You better stay here. But they said, no, they said it was all right. Please, never mind, back and forth. And then I thought, my, this can't go on forever because we're kind of losing control. They're making friends, and I would decide on having parties or get-togethers at somebody else's house. I don't know who they are, the parents are strangers. And we have to have some kind of system here. And same went on the daytime. They would go around in groups. We didn't know where our children were. So then a few of us got together and we said, let's ask for some kind of a school system. Let's get together and organize some kind of a YWCA and a YMCA, a college group, a high school group, and have a leader.